work session to order.
Yeah, I'll do roll call. Chair Sherwood. Vice Chair Gill. McGinley.
Present.
Bergen.
Here.
Landon.
Present.
Coivilla.
Here.
Bose.
Here.
Thank you.
All right, so we have on the agenda today the development code update. So Mark is here. Now, do you want to talk about this
after? So, Commissioner Coivilla had sent along a newspaper article from the Register Guard that talked about the Land Use Board of Appeals case out of Eugene and wanted some information from staff about how that could impact Springfield potentially. We have a legal extern in our office for this semester from U of L Law, and so it was a good project to give to her. So her longer memo and case brief is attached, but I also wanted to give you just a one-page kind of highlight to talk about tonight. Essentially what happened in Eugene is they readopted their development code about 20 years ago, similar to, I think, the process we're going through now. And in doing so, they have a lot of overlay districts and things that apply in Eugene, similar to how we do in Springfield. And they repealed some of those standards and readopted new standards and repealed and readopted maps. And essentially for this one district, the site review sub-district, I think they intended to become the site review overlay district, but they didn't specifically make that connection in the code or the ordinance. And they did not readopt any of the old maps that had gone along with that site review district or those standards. And so when property came in the Whitaker area to develop, the city's opinion was that they had to go through site review, which is similar to our site plan process, I think. And the developer argued that that was not applicable. It was repealed, and the standards weren't applied to that property when they were readopted, and LUBA agreed with the property owner. I think it has a potential for a lot of impact in Eugene because there's an argument that their planned unit development, which is a bigger deal for them, was adopted, was sort of readopted in a similar way. And so that could have a big impact for how, what process different land develops in the city of Eugene and what standards it's subject to. We don't have an issue, I think, with looking back and what's in our code. We shouldn't have any similar issues, but it is something for us to pay a lot of attention to going forward. The case is on appeal, the Oregon Court of Appeals, so there may be a different decision out of the Oregon Court of Appeals or different guidance from them, but I think that it does raise kind of three points for us to be thinking about, that it won't be wrong to be paying attention to them. Even if the Oregon Court of Appeals says that LUBA was wrong, we should still be paying attention to trying to avoid some of those issues. One thing that we should do is that the new code and the ordinances, like the actual, you know, cover page and the whereas clauses and all of that, should be really clear as we're getting into those overlay zones, which overlay zones are going to continue to apply and just have a new code or a new section, and which are actually being repealed and not replaced. For example, if, you know, nodal development, if the nodal development overlay goes away, we should be really explicit that it's going away and not being replaced by something, versus if we have the hillside development overlay, we should be really clear that that is continuing and it's continuing in what form. If we have maps that are referenced in the current code, we should make sure that the same maps are referenced in the new code, or that the council adopts the right maps by council action. City of Eugene staff had essentially put together a map that had the same title as a map referenced in the code, and the argument that they raised was that that was adequate to make that map legally binding, and LUBA said that's not what an official map means. Like, the council actually has to take some action in order for something to be an official map. We could have had the same issue with our conceptual local street map, but the council just, as you know, repealed that as part of the new code standards, so that's no longer an issue as soon as that takes effect. And then I think that's it. It's really just about making sure that we're really clear about what we're doing and that we're properly referencing and readopting things. And I think that should be, you know, with the benefit of hindsight being 2020, that should be easy for us to incorporate as we move forward. Any questions? Yeah.
Speaking of LUBA, now,
This may be something if we could hold till the end of the meeting, since we're getting on off track from our agenda regarding LUBA challenges. Mm-hmm. So should I defer on that for a while, or do you want to listen to a question at this point?
I think go ahead. Yeah.
I have, through my time on the Planning Commission, we've had two challenges presented to LUBA. One was on the Phase 1 Glenwood Refinement Plan, and we were regularly updated on the process and how things were meandering through the challenges and so forth. But the LUBA challenge that occurred on North Fifth Street, I, or maybe none of us, have heard anything about what the issues were that were presented and how they were resolved. Do you have any background on that at all?
The North Fifth Street ones?
Right.
I think we provided memos to the City Council as we, so that was part of something that worked through the City Council, but I don't know whether we updated the Planning Commission. It was remanded to the City Council. They readopted the decision with some new findings. That was appealed, and then the appeal was dropped, and they settled. And the settlement had to do with some concessions the developer made in the number of units and windows and where they those would be. But since then, the property has changed hands and is being developed by Homes for Good. My understanding that Homes for Good has worked with some of the same neighbors, but it was a different it was a site plan decision was different than what was originally envisioned. So
the original challenge was denied by LUBA?
The original challenge was upheld by LUBA that some of the findings were deficient, so the City Council adopted new findings. The sub-decisions that you made in conjunction with the hearings official this summer have been appealed to LUBA, and those are at LUBA right now. We are still working on finalizing the record, so we don't know what the grounds for appeal of that decision will be, but I can certainly update the Planning Commission on how that goes if it's something you're interested in.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks. All right. If nothing else, then March.
On to the code. Well, tonight I'm here to report to you about moving into a new phase of the code update project. Chair Gill, or co-chair Gill, tonight got a preview of the presentation that basically the same one I'll be giving tonight that I gave to the City Council last night. And I'll just start off with the direction that the council gave us last night is to go ahead and move forward with the public outreach steps of the housing phase of the code update. So that's what we were asking them for, and they said yes, go forward. So that's exciting for us to move into that next step. In addition, that kind of coincides with also then moving into phase two of the project, which is for the commercial and industrial lands, or sometimes I refer to it as the employment lands phase of the project. So some of the first steps associated with that phase two will be to recruit for a new TAC, a technical advisory committee, for that phase, and then proceed to a similar process that we did for the housing phase. I will just mention you do have the packet materials in front of you tonight. Those are for your binders, if you're keeping your binders up to date. And then I also provided you a copy of the PowerPoint slides that I'll go through tonight. So you've seen the project schedule a bunch of times, but what I thought I'd do is do kind of a quick recap of how we've gotten to where we are tonight. I think it's a pretty exciting point to now be moving out of doing the audit and drafting some code to actually releasing it to the public. This has been a culmination of over a year of work since we started in roughly September of 2018. For the housing phase. We did, as you'll recall, extend the timeline at one point to incorporate the new middle housing provisions that was adopted by the state legislation. And so that's reflected on the timeline as well. The project objectives, as were adopted by this body acting as the CCI, in the community engagement plan are here on this slide. You've seen these a number of times as well. I'm not going to go through them tonight, but just wanted to recap that we're still working with the same set of project objectives. This slide I showed you early on back over a year ago about trying to figure out how to balance those different objectives. Some of them could be contradictory to one another. I've felt like this at times throughout the process. It's definitely keeping me on my toes and trying to balance all of the different inputs we've been getting from the different directions on the project. I just wanted to say, okay, I'll touch on that in a minute. That, so in moving forward, I told the council last night, and it'll be applicable to the Planning Commission too, it's ultimately up to these bodies to figure out where that right balance is for weighing those objectives and finding the points with the code and how we want to implement the vision moving forward. As you'll recall, too, the code audit report was early on in the process, has informed what we've been moving forward with. This code audit report was performed by a consultant that was hired through a grant that we received from the state to pay for that. This was prior to the legislation being adopted, so it didn't necessarily consider the new middle housing legislation, but it did have some of those forward-thinking ideas as well as the original objectives from the council with the project in general prior to the middle housing legislation coming on board, was that we are trying to find ways to encourage more housing, make it easier to develop, provide flexibility with development, those kind of things. So these are the short summary from that audit report. It was a 26-page report. So just up front in the report, though, kind of the executive summary is included here as well. One of the things I'll just note is some of the driving force behind the code update in general, especially for housing, is creating clear and objective standards. So that is also a state mandate that cities have clear and objective standards for approving all housing types. And our code currently doesn't necessarily meet that in all areas. So that's definitely been a key point in trying to write the new provisions. And we've talked about before is having the clear and objective tracked is one option, but also providing additional flexibility through an alternative path if developers want to choose that path for discretionary or subjective criteria that would provide them more flexibility. This is a quick recap of all the meetings we've had to date. So between the four different bodies, the City Council, the Planning Commission, the Governance Committee, and the Technical Advisory Committee, there's I think well over 20 meetings we've had over the last year plus. In addition to these meeting dates, we've presented information to different groups around the community about the process and what we're doing. That has included the Chamber of Commerce, Economic Development Committee, the Springfield City Club, as well as I think most of you were aware, we did the podcast for the YIMBY podcast that is being produced. There's a couple, I also attended a Better Housing Together meeting and presented to that group. And there's upcoming meetings that we're scheduling as well to continue to talk about the process and engaging the community. This is the list of the TAC committee members. There were originally 14 appointed by this body as the CCI. Two of the members throughout the year plus have had to drop off the committee, but there's still 12. We do intend to continue to meet with this TAC as we move into the public outreach phase of the housing part of the project, as well as then I'll be coming back to this body to appoint a new TAC for the employment phase. I do want to say, so in your packet, the attachment 2 is a two-sided page where the front is the narrative and the back is primarily just this table of 10 things. It's intended to be a summary of the major changes of the code and point out where in the old code some of the provisions lived and then where in the new code. So my plan is to just kind of walk through this table with you tonight, and then we can get into more discussion about any of the changes. Some of these are, I would say, bigger discussion topics, others maybe not so much. I will point out on the front of this page, in the narrative part, there is a typo. It's in the paragraph just under the list of seven things towards the top. The third line of that paragraph is the number 3.2.300. That should be 3.2.200. So that's just a typo. The existing section that's referring to is 3.2-200. We're changing the number formatting, but that we didn't intend to change the actual number, but just the format there. So that was a typo. I will say, just in general, this version of these code sections that you have before you tonight are very rough early drafts. I have been kind of referring to them as a 50% draft. So the idea is that we'll take them out to the public to get early feedback, rather than taking them like a polished product that's completely done. So we recognize that there's quite a bit of work still to do on these code sections. In addition to that, there will be revisions to existing sections of the code that aren't being replaced yet at this point to help implement these new sections. So those will be coming back to you and be put in front of the public later as well. I also just wanted to mention that as we move into the public outreach steps for the housing phase, we are not going to just release these code sections and say, here it is, take a look. So a lot of the public outreach will involve a bunch of other materials to help explain and put the changes into a much more easy to understand kind of fact sheet formats. And as we move forward with doing community engagement events and putting stuff on our website, it'll be in a different format rather than just these code sections. So with that, I'll just start down the table unless there's any questions about anything at this point that I've talked about. So the first part, basically items number one and two are directly as a result of the new housing legislation, the middle housing legislation. The one thing I'll mention up front too is we're intending to move completely away from the terminology of talking about using the word family in describing housing. So currently we talk about single family homes, or sometimes our code is, the existing code's a little inconsistent in talking about multi-unit development, but it also refers sometimes to multi-family development. So our intent is to move away from using the term family at all and talk about single unit detached, either housing or dwelling, and then multi-unit housing or multi-unit dwellings. So I still slip up and say family sometimes, but the intent is to move away from using that terminology. So that, as we've talked about before, the new middle housing legislation is requiring us to allow duplexes on any lot that's zoned for single family residential use. So that's really these big changes in now trying to implement the middle housing legislation. I was just in Salem today again on the technical advisory committee at the state level for figuring out how to implement that legislation. So trying to keep abreast of all how the state is seeing how to implement that legislation and tie that into the code, that'll be kind of an ongoing process, and likely other revisions will have to happen in order to stay in line with how the state will say we have to implement that. But based on everything to this point, I feel like the draft code is pretty close to being in line with where they're going. So in addition to the duplexes, there's also triplexes, fourplexes, townhomes. Those also we're allowed by the legislation to have siting and design standards for, as long as they're reasonable. They don't create, I think the terminology is, they don't create unreasonable cost and delay. So we are proposing basically to allow those housing types without really, with very minimal standards. And it's based primarily on density. So however big your lot size is really what's going to drive how many units you can have. that traditionally hasn't been the case, particularly in our low-density residential zone. Essentially, regardless of how big your lot is, you could only essentially do one unit, one single-family unit on the lot, other than the ADU provisions that are allowed now. And if you have questions along the way going down this list, I'm happy to talk about those, but otherwise I'll just keep going and we can talk about it all at the end too. So item number three, currently we have both a cluster subdivision section of our code and we have a cottage, I think it's cottage housing, it might be a slightly different term.
Cottage cluster
section of our code. And really it's not, I wouldn't even call it a section of the code, there's just really a few mentions of cottage clusters in our code and it's not entirely clear how those would be implemented the way they're written into the code today. We're proposing to basically combine those two sections. This would be a very kind of unique and very flexible type of development opportunity for people to develop cottage housing. The cottage part of the name in my mind refers to the size, so there's some limitations on the size of the dwellings. And then there's also the clustering part of the name, which talks about, you know, where on the property they're sited and maybe they're preserving some open space or part of the property that doesn't necessarily lend itself to being developed. There's some question about, in combining these two sections, it eliminates the opportunity to do just a strict cluster subdivision detached from the cottage housing type. So if I'll use like Mountain Gate as an example, there's some phases of Mountain Gate where they have, you know, are on a hillside where part of the property may not be developable. So they've clustered the houses up on the developed part and they've built, you know, single family homes, whatever size they are, not limited to a maximum size, so they're not cottages. So the way these are combined and proposed now in this draft is that there is not the opportunity to do just a cluster subdivision that could have any size home on it. So I think that'll be a point for discussion in the future, is do we want to split back out the cluster subdivision opportunity to provide that flexibility for a subdivision that would allow homes of any size and not be combined with the cottage housing part of that section the way it's written now. So number four on the list is the multi-unit housing section. This has changed significantly in my mind for a couple of reasons. And one is because of the new middle housing provisions, we've pulled out, so currently multi-family or multi-unit housing is defined as three units or more. So a triplex today is considered multi-unit and a fourplex today is considered multi-unit. So those will come out of the multi-unit category and be in this new middle housing category. So multi-unit housing will only be five units or more. And that's also accepting out the cottage housing provisions that we just talked about, because there can be more than five units in cottage housing. The other reason I think it's significant is because currently multi-unit housing has to go through site plan review in our code. The way the site plan review today is written is not clear and objective. So again, today for any multi-unit housing, three units or more, has to go through site plan development or site plan review. That's a subjective land use decision process. The way it's rewritten and proposed is to have it still have a review process, but it's clear and objective and it wouldn't be qualified as a land use decision. So it would be a type one process. There would not necessarily be notice sent to surrounding property owners. It's almost more like a ministerial checklist type of process with clear and objective standards. Section five is the solar development standards. So both the housing audit report that was performed by the consultant, as well as the feedback we received from our TAC, was that these solar development standards create a barrier to development. and recommended removing these development standards. So that is what is proposed, is to completely eliminate the solar development standard section of the code. I kind of skipped over it, and I mentioned it last night, but as part of the narrative on the front of this page we're talking about, attachment two, I talk about the reduced length of the code, and I'll just touch on that now, because the solar development standards are, in my mind, a significant piece of the existing code. So the first section of code that you have in front of you tonight is section 3.2, and that is the residential zoning district section. Currently, the section of the existing code is 66 pages long. The new section is down to 11 pages. I think it's also the number 11. 11 of the existing 66 pages are just the solar development standard. So it's a large chunk of code that's very complex and difficult to even understand and figure out how to implement and use. So anyway, that is a big piece that we've proposed to eliminate. I'll just mention...
Could you just talk about what the impact of eliminating that would be?
Sure, the solar development standards. Yeah, so primarily I would say the solar development standards regulate shadows being cast on properties that would be to the north of a property. So it would regulate, in my mind, and this is very simplified, but regulate primarily two things, and that is either the setback of the a structure from the northern property line and or the height of a structure. So it's regulating how much shadow can be cast onto those adjacent properties. Yeah.
That's somewhat surprising because I remember when solar development in serious form came into vogue, mm-hmm. and it was almost mandatory that the provision be made for solar access and solar awareness, because I know that at one time subdivisions were actually platted with awareness of solar access and solar impact, so that lot sizes varied depending on whether they face north, south, or east, west as to their frontage because of that.
That's correct.
Seems to be a changing mindset on solar development, I guess.
And that was a question I think Commissioner McGinley asked back in the joint work session maybe about the north, south, and east, west lot orientation. Mm-hmm. So that's currently in our code today, and we propose to eliminate that because you're right, the lot sizes vary depending on the orientation. Mm-hmm. We've simplified that and basically have said that it doesn't matter the orientation. One, the lot size and the frontage is just one size fits all. It's not always that simple or straightforward with development that the streets are on a grid and face east, west, or north, south, as you can imagine. And you're right, the opportunity to have access to solar is something that may and probably is still valued. So that may be an area that we look at, do we really want to completely eliminate it or not? I think in my mind, in having worked with solar standards before and seeing the ones we currently have, they're, have evolved from, say, like the 70s or the era of when more passive solar was, I think, the thought of how people wanted to access solar versus more active solar panels on roofs and things that are probably the majority of solar today, but... Did you have a comment?
Yeah, one thing to be aware of is that some recent changes from 2017 and then this last session now state that the city can't deny or condition an application that reduces the height of that application below the maximum for the zoning district. And so that's one area of state law that could preempt, if we were to leave these in place, it could preempt application of them in the way that they're currently drafted anyway. So that's something to keep in mind.
There also is the statewide planning goals, and I can't remember for sure. I think it might be goal 6, is air, water, energy. So that goal, I think, contemplates some of the need for application of solar standards potentially. So at some point, we probably need to think about how that's going to impact the goal 6 findings that we'll write as well. Okay. So, and then the second half of the table, items 6 through 10, Item six, we are proposing to make some minor adjustments to the ADU provisions. So those were fairly recently adopted and are being used. So through our experience with using the ADU provisions, we've had quite a few number of ADU applications come in and people asking about them. Through that experience, we've identified a few things that we think would be worthwhile to revisit in the code. One of those is there's an articulation requirement. So any wall longer than 25 feet has to have some articulation built into it. We're proposing to remove that requirement, as well as there's a height limit for ADUs that I think it reads something like that it can't be taller than the main house or the main structure on the property. So somebody couldn't build a detached garage with an ADU on top of it if all you have is a single story house. So I know that from talking with the current planners, talking with folks at our counter, that question has come up a number of times. It's like, why can't I do that? So we're proposing to remove that height limit, and essentially an ADU could meet the same height limit as any primary structure in the zoning district. The other thing we're changing is to implement House Bill 2001 legislation that required a change that said we can no longer require an off-street parking space for approving ADUs. So we're not implementing that requirement any longer as of the first of the year, but we're making that formal change in our code now. The item number seven is consolidation of residential development standards. This really has to do with trying to make the code more easy to use. So the new section that's before you, the second one of the three that's in front of you is 4.7. We've taken standards out of three different sections and put them in this one section. So with our existing code today, there's different development standards located in different sections. So depending on what you're doing, you have to flip to different areas. So in terms of ease of use, we've taken those different development standards and put them all in one spot to hopefully make it easier to use. There will still be some back and forth flipping between sections and chapters, but this will help streamline that process a little bit. That's primarily what number seven is talking about. The number eight is related to kind of what we were talking about at the start of the list, the duplex, triplex definitions. So the third section before you tonight is some new definitions section. So basically, we'll be building a new definition section as we adopt and update the entire development code. There will still be the old development code definition section, but as we adopt new definitions, we'll likely pull the majority of them out of the old sections. Some of them will likely be duplicative if they apply to both housing and other development, with the idea that we'll eventually end up with a completely new section. But we are proposing to define duplex, triplex, fourplex as any two, three, or four units on a lot, and regardless of the configuration. So whether they're attached, detached, or vertically or horizontally mixed within an existing structure. I think that just in my meeting today in Salem, that's, I would say, a lively discussion about how those things get defined. Some people think the more traditional definition of a duplex being two units side by side attached with a common wall should be the way we look at it, or are they thinking that that's the intent of the legislation? This is written to provide the most flexibility for infill and redevelopment on a property, say if they don't want to tear down the existing house but still add a unit, and just different ways of configuring properties to get more units on a property without having to build a more traditional type of single building with multiple units in it. And then, so number nine on the list, we're proposing to reduce the minimum lot size. So this is based on the adopted density range for the low density residential zone. Currently, the minimum lot size is the 4,500 square feet, which does not allow a developer to get to the maximum density allowed in that zone. There's a parallel zone, the SLR, the small lot residential zone, that exists on paper only in our zoning code, but there's none of it that actually exists on the ground. My understanding is that that zone was created to implement, to get to the high end of the density range for the LDR zone. It's within the same comprehensive plan designation. But in order to implement that zone, somebody would have to go primarily through a master plan development proposal, which is a very subjective process. So again, leaning on trying to find a clear and objective standard path, for all intents and purposes, we're making the LDR zone and the SLR zone the same. And we're not proposing to remove the SLR zone primarily because it exists also in our comprehensive plan. And to the extent we can, we're trying to avoid doing comprehensive plan amendments at this point with the code update. So this was the way we saw as reaching the same set of standards without doing a comprehensive plan designation or comprehensive plan amendment.
Question.
Sure.
The reducing of the minimum lot size, that could be done both through a new subdivision and also through lot line adjustments or replats or short subdivisions?
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's correct, yeah.
Okay.
So again, kind of infill opportunity.
Sure.
Do you know about the average density within our LDR zone?
You mean for like new development or existing areas?
Existing areas. I recall hearing Bend like wasn't even close to their maximum.
Yeah. I mean, so the current range is 6 to 14 that's allowed in the LDR. Just off the top of my head guess is that we're probably average at the middle of that range or somewhere even potentially below the middle of that range. I think even some of the new subdivisions, like if you pick a Hayden subdivision, and that's some of the more dense new single family home neighborhoods, are probably somewhere in the 9 to 10 units per acre range. So trying to get to that 14 units per acre is really difficult.
Thank you.
And I'll just mention too, some of that is changing because now, one, ADUs are allowed, and those are exempt from density. And I've talked about this with you before too. In theory, somebody could now double the density, or as proposed with the new code, in theory, somebody could double the density if they came in and platted a bunch of 3,000 square foot lots and put a single family home and an ADU on each one of them. That would be over the maximum density. We're also proposing that the dynamic because middle housing legislation requires us to allow duplexes on every lot now, that's how the duplexes would work as well, that they would be exempt from the maximum density. And that, so in theory, again, somebody could plat out 3,000 square foot lots and put duplexes on each one, and that would essentially double the density. And that's consistent with the discussion happening at the state level. It's recognized that that is how it's set up. And the idea is to encourage more production of housing. And so that it's recognized that that's the intent primarily.
Of course, then the issue becomes the lot coverage standards. Is going to be more and more important. Be aware of those, whatever project you plan.
That's correct.
More structure on smaller lots.
Yeah. Well, in some regard, it may encourage smaller units as well.
More vertical.
Or just smaller square footage. So you could build, say, a 2,000 square foot house, or you could build two 1,000 square foot dwellings. Mm-hmm. You could split that up.
More multi-story than single story.
Yeah, and so all the, not only lot coverage, but the height limit and the setbacks create that developable envelope. Something else we talked about at the council last night is stormwater provisions. So the stormwater provisions themselves requiring to deal with stormwater runoff could in and of itself limit how much density or how much lot coverage happens on an individual property. If we're moving towards requiring stormwater runoff to be handled on the individual properties, which that's all in flux right now with our state stormwater and clean water permits and those kind of things. So it's yet to be seen exactly how that will play out, but that is definitely something to keep in our minds.
In theory, would you allow stormwater treatment area to be counted as part of the open space requirement?
So for like, yes, the short answer is yes. I think that's the way it's written in here for both middle housing and for the multi-unit housing.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah. And so the last one on the list is just simplifying the land use, the use table itself. And again, reiterating what I said before about this is a 50% draft. I recognize that this use table needs a little work still. I mean, there's definitely things to iron out and likely things that will be added back to this use table, but this is an attempt to simplify the use table from what we have today. So with that, that's basically the extent of my formal presentation. I'm happy to talk about anything more in depth or answer other questions or whatever you want to do.
All right, are there questions?
So, I was just going to talk about next steps, and we can do that at the end if you want to talk now. And Christine is raising
her hand. The question about stormwater applies to something for me that I had seen earlier. The code currently talks about that it must be usable open space. That what's usable isn't defined, though.
Okay.
So I think that's an area maybe to provide more clarification.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking of, if a developer opted for like a rain garden or something.
And it may be different for, I'll double check in the code, but it may be different for middle housing, how it's written for multi-unit housing.
Yeah, that's, I'm just looking at the triplex and fourplex.
Okay.
And it may, yeah, I think it probably is different.
I can follow up on that piece.
Thank you.
I mean, so really the next step plan is that, as council gave us direction to, there are typos in here. One I'm going to fix specifically references the City of Bend provisions for, I think, home occupations or boarding houses.
Compliance form for
Bend accessory. Yeah, so there's a few references that I'll correct like that before. We don't want people referring to the City of Bend codes for our stuff. But as I've said before, you know, I've cut and pasted and stolen code provisions.
You know what that will be amended to? I mean, is there going to be a City of Springfield form in its place? Or how is it going to be altered?
And which page is that on?
That's on page 21 of Attachment 4.
Mm-hmm.
A half bathroom.
So this is accessory uses and structures.
And B, restrictions.
Right.
Is there going to be a compliance form that's...
Yeah, I'll have to look at that. Right. I don't think we have a form like that today. That is something we can look at. There is another reference to City Bend, I think, in the, some other provision. I forget where it was pointed out last night that I have noted. So, but other than that, I intend to move forward with releasing these draft code sections to the public and starting those public engagement opportunities and steps, putting stuff on our website, scheduling community engagement events and those types of things. And in tandem with that, we will also be kicking off the employment phase, as I mentioned, and recruiting for a technical advisory for that phase of the project. These are the categories for the areas of representatives within the community that we hope to recruit for the Technical Advisory Committee. These were approved as part of the community engagement plan originally, and we'll have to look at how those get filled and if we can fill them all and the flexibility this group will have in appointing those members as we get applications for that.
So regarding the new technical advisory versus the current technical advisory,
mm-hmm.
are you going to solicit those that are already on there first? Are there people who have expressed interest? Or if there are other people who are from the similar category that also apply, and then do the people that want to be on the new TAC, will they have to reapply?
So a bunch of questions there.
A lot of questions. I was just throwing them all at you.
Yeah, that's great. We've thought about this. So really the idea is that there definitely is some interest from my existing TAC members to be on the new TAC. I've explored that and landed on the fact that they will have to reapply to be on the new TAC. We won't necessarily give preference to those applicants, although this group can decide that, I think. I mean, ultimately, this group is the one that will appoint those members. But I think it will just be an open posting for TAC applicants, and that there won't be, you know, we'll recruit from the existing TAC first and then go out for others. It'll just be one big opening recruitment. I'm trying to think of what other questions were in there that I may not have answered.
It seemed like you summed it up pretty good.
Yeah. So that's how we envision it, is that, you know, there may be some members on the existing TAC that might not neatly fit in one of these categories. And so, I think this group could use your judgment or discretion in how these categories get filled. You know, specifically the last one on here, Springfield resident. So that could be anybody that lives in Springfield. Out of all the other ones, they don't necessarily have to live in Springfield, so they could be engaged in other efforts and not necessarily live in Springfield too. So I think there's some flexibility there.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions,
Tim? If it's possible to take a step backward and go back to December 3rd when we met on the middle housing language.
Okay.
We ran out of time before we could finish all the work.
Okay.
And so there were a couple of things that I had in mind that didn't express since we ran into a 7 o'clock. And one is, in regard to proposed language, since we're still looking at that, is the question of transit availability.
Mm-hmm.
And the concern that I have is that transit availability in Springfield is not very well balanced, because I don't think there's any availability south of Main Street anywhere in Springfield other than that park and ride down by Straub Parkway. Okay. So I think that creates problems as far as people that can or can't comply with that requirement. Plus the fact, I think the second issue is, with that requirement is, right now LTD is looking at route coverage and altering routes,
mm-hmm.
and so you could potentially have someone who's compliance one day and then out of compliance the next in the middle of a project.
Yeah.
So I have a little bit of concern about that requirement, whether it's really necessary. I realize the positives of having that access, but whether it really should be a requirement for a project to take place.
So not necessarily having opportunity for, say, more density or more flexible development standards if you're proximate to a transit district, you don't think that's equitable potentially?
Well, that is true, because it's a matter of, okay, some people are going to be able to fit into that compliance standard and some people aren't.
Mm-hmm.
And it is maybe a sense of fairness to say, well, you can, but you can't just because of where the bus route happens to go.
Right.
Because I think even on the north side of Main Street, there's a lot of areas that don't have route coverage. And so you're really limiting the percentage of the land area that can comply with that standard.
Mm-hmm.
So that is something of a concern.
Yeah, and I think it's a valid concern and comment for sure. And so something that we can all take into consideration through the process. There may be opportunities to consider other because, as you mentioned, those routes may change, and I know LTD is thinking about some potential, I think, rerouting. But so potentially looking at corridors based on our transportation system rather than something that we don't control, which is the transit system, So maybe proximity to major arterials or certain, you know, major thoroughfares, regardless of transit. So that's just off the top of my head, but yeah, it's a valid point, I think, for sure.
And the other point on looking through the material from December is, and I don't think it's touched on very briefly here, the requirement on middle housing projects to have underground irrigation.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think given that we're having larger and larger buildings on smaller and smaller lots, that all underground irrigation would result in is higher building costs.
And that I should have, that provision is removed.
Oh, okay.
And that should no longer be in there.
Oh, all right. Okay.
We did pull.
Okay.
Along with a number of other standards that both the council and this group weighed in on as increasing the cost of development.
Yeah.
So,
okay.
Yeah, that should no longer be in there.
Okay, thanks.
Mm-hmm.
Other comments or questions? Go ahead, Mike.
A couple different things. I think that they all kind of tie together into one question / comment, but it's pretty expansive.
Okay.
The heights and the setbacks, to me, if I start thinking about a 40-foot building that has like a 5-foot setback and daylight basement is excluded, and if it's built like, say, my house is, then you've got a crawl space under the daylight basement. You've got this gigantic, tall ceiling daylight basement. And then if you allow 2.5 stories on top of that, and you push all that to within 5 foot of a sideline or a rear lot line, to me, it's kind of an unconscionable development for a single family area. That also ties in with the solar standards. And I'm a big believer in passive solar. I've got a garden, I've got a greenhouse. The side of my house, it just catches a lot of sun.
Mm-hmm.
I'd really hate to see those go away entirely. And so in combination with that, looking at the fourplexes and threeplexes, I'm kind of worried about them for a lot of different reasons. The solar, the height and the setbacks. Also, really honestly, I think that installing some of these things in neighborhoods, and I know this is a NIMBY sort of thing, but it, to my mind, it affects the quality of the neighborhood, and it also would reduce property values in a neighborhood if you were to shoehorn a few of these things into an existing neighborhood, requiring little amount of off-site parking, etc. I think basically it would be kind of ruinous in some areas. So, like I said, they all kind of tie together into one level of concern.
Mm-hmm. I don't know that you need me to respond. It's definitely the balance between densifying and, sprawling.
Mm-hmm.
Really, it's a classic argument about what's better or worse and those kind of things. So.
Okay, thanks.
Mm-hmm.
Can you sum up what you heard from council last night?
Yeah, let's see. So Commissioner Gill was there, and we have Councillor Stair here. So if I misspeak, or they can add or even start if they'd like. In fact, I could give Councillor Stair the floor if you'd like to offer any comments.
Well, I think I asked about the what constitutes a cottage cluster as opposed to a townhouse.
Right.
And then I did ask about the solar, about the solar development standards.
Yeah.
I remember that, and I think there were questions as well about how the consistency of the building standards would be for two separate buildings on the same lot, whether there would be a different height that would be allowed for one house and a single story for one and then a third story for another. And I think the answer was that there wouldn't be any three-story houses of just due to current zoning law,
right.
but that a two-story house would in fact be possible.
Mm-hmm.
I think you were there too, Sandy. Were there other questions?
I do have my notes, the little bit of chicken scratch that I was able to make. you bring up a good point about the height, and I'll just point out that there are a couple, for the most part, this is all brand new code, and I didn't try and do any kind of track changes of existing versus new. But there are two areas in the draft section 3.2 that I highlighted in red what the existing provisions are. And one of those is for the existing building heights on page 8 of 12. It's attachment 3. And then one page before that, page 7 of 12, I also included in red what the existing lot coverages are. So you can see what's proposed compared to what's existing. We are proposing, in most cases, to increase both lot coverage across the board and height. So as Councilor Starr just referred to, two stories versus three stories, in the LDR zone, we're proposing to raise the height limit from the existing 30-foot height limit to 35-foot height limit. So whether or not that would make the difference of going from two stories to three, depending on how you calculate height. I will just mention the comment you had about daylight basements and some of that, 2.5 stories. So originally we had contemplated in the cottage cluster housing specifically measuring height by number of stories. We have taken that out. We reverted back to a pure height number rather than trying to figure out numbers of stories. And I believe that whole daylight basement language came out as well when we did that.
I think it's still there.
Okay.
It's still there.
So that may be something we need to work on. But anyway, the height is something, you know, that is one of those things. Again, it's that balancing act. We're going to have to figure out what how to balance all these provisions.
I remember, I think it was Councilor Van Gordon also asked, with a relaxed standard on what constitutes a duplex, mm-hmm. what the difference between a duplex and an ADU was going to be.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. And that was another point we spent probably half hour talking about the state today. There's this dynamic that could be set up where an existing detached single-family home builds an ADU, and then now with the new duplex provisions comes in and wants to add a duplex unit, because they can, the middle housing says you can build a duplex anywhere there's a single family homes allowed. So the question is will it end up with three units potentially on that lot, two duplex units with the ADU? And so defining the terms and being very clear about how. The first off in my mind, the question is, do we want to set it up to allow that or not as a policy decision? And then depending on the answer to that question, making sure the provisions are set up in a way that either does or doesn't allow it very clearly the way we want it to work.
Tim?
Did that answer your question, kind of a summary of what, you know, I mentioned stormwater earlier, other infrastructure questions a little bit to do with sewer and street capacity. The parking question, I think, came up a little bit last night. Maintenance costs for some of these, like stormwater. Councilor Van Gordon touched on the employee restriction under the bed and breakfast provisions. That was a thought he had about maybe we don't need that. There are some other questions about how Airbnbs fit in with bed and breakfast or not, and so we'll be doing some follow-up to make sure those provisions are all written accordingly.
They also brought up support forms, so the process of using this, and that there might be forms that help calculate the density issues and those kinds of things, so they were looking at the usability of this too. Mm-hmm.
And so the only other item I remember from council that I had noted that we haven't raised yet came from the mayor, both in terms of two things. One, allowing all this middle housing, how will that affect our infrastructure? We talked about stormwater, but what about sewer? And then the other thing is these usable outdoor space, like where are people going to do their barbecuing? Is it going to be on the sidewalk? Is there going to be a place on the property? How do we find that same balance? And by housing type, does it matter?
Tim?
One just little nitpicky thing when we looking at page 7 on attachment 3 on the lot coverage chart, I would suggest on that heading stating maximum lot coverage, mm-hmm. throwing that in there as a clarifying
okay.
item.
So, unless there are other questions, I think earlier I heard Mark say that we can send specific detail items that we see in there, typos or questions about clarity. I know I have a few suggestions because I was reading this like, okay, if I don't know how to read a code and I want to build something, can I do it? Like, do I get this? And so I think there's some of the sections have some introduction, some of them don't. Some of those appear in the definitions, but some of them don't. So so I was looking at things like that. There are a few places where, like attachment 3, page 6 of 12, at the top, it continues number 5 from the page before, mm-hmm. about setbacks, and then it says, it lists items that can be in those setbacks, eaves, chimneys, including, and then it says, and similar architectural features. That doesn't seem very clear and objective. So is that in another section? And then there are other sections like this that say, here are some examples, but they don't have and similar. So just, are those things that you want us to look at and catch and bring up to you?
Definitely, okay. Yeah, I would say for sure. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So
yeah, all of that. I mean, so in my mind, now that we're moving forward to the public involvement phase, so I'm going to be compiling all of these comments, and obviously you are all part of the public, so any of those comments are definitely, I'm glad to get, and especially since your eyes are on this, and I want as much input as I can get, the better, yeah.
Well, I think, too, that since we're all here, if you have any detailed things that you're thinking about, just person to person, that maybe we'd want to share your thoughts, too. So rather than saying, well, you'll talk individually, maybe it's information we'd all be interested in.
Well, those were just a couple big ones that I will continue to look for because there are items listed like that. And I know that's a dangerous thing to do. Unless we refer somewhere else, so, and trying to avoid having to refer somewhere else.
Right.
So, you did mention that the number of pages is smaller, but sometimes we don't want that at the expense of understanding it. So,
right.
a few descriptors of what we're talking about. Like, I found it when I'm looking at lot coverage. There's no really description about what that means, and I noted the maximum minimum part in there as well.
Okay.
And then I was like, okay, well, how does that deal with density? But then density came next.
Mm-hmm.
And then that one does have a little bit of description, but could use more before it goes into the details. So, some people might not know the difference between what those two things address.
Right.
Right, so.
And density is one of those lengthy sections that I think we talked a bit about last night in terms of having a form that helps you understand how it's to be calculated.
Right.
I agree that there's definitely opportunity to refine this, have it be more internally consistent and more clarity. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. All that input would be.
I mean, helpful. I think it's awesome. I just want to know what kinds of things you're looking for.
Yeah, all of it.
Okay.
Yeah. It'll be a group effort.
All right. Other comments or thoughts on this? Well, let Troy have a chance.
Yeah.
Go for it, Troy.
Hey, I just want to clarify based on what was just being said. So, is Mark looking for feedback? Through email, if it's only clarifying points, or are you interested in feedback related to whether or not an item looks like it makes sense, like to be in there in general? So if I agree with the piece being in there, is that
say probably more focused on the former of what you said. In my mind, of what you're at, the second part of what you're asking is really probably more appropriate for when the Planning Commission considers the public hearing draft and through the public hearings process. Although, again, you're a member of the public, and I'm open to any feedback from the public, so I don't want to discourage you from providing that. It's just that you, being on the Planning Commission, will get a special opportunity to provide that specific input, that you will also be considering all of the public input once you hear responses from the public input, both through this informal process and then through the public hearing process, and then after your public hearing, developing a Planning Commission recommendation. So anyway, all that to say, give me whatever you want, but
okay.
I'm not sure if that specifically answered your question. I think I'm open to all of it, for sure, but just keep in mind that, you know, I'm going to be taking all of your input at this point, kind of in conjunction with the general public input, and moving forward to an ultimate public hearing draft that will come before this body. Okay.
It talks about home business uses that are prohibited. I just wanted to inquire, first off, what is the process in determining prohibited uses? I mean, at least so far, and I know it's a draft, but where have these ideas come from? And the follow-up to that is I'd like to see this be talked about, because I think this is a very subjective list, and the other thing is that even if we are going for what we're going for on here, for instance, it says karate and judo instruction, and not arguing against karate and judo instruction in neighborhood, but why not boxing? Why not all martial arts? So that could be more clear or more generalized. And then there are other things that maybe make more or less sense to be on here. So I wanted to ask that.
Yeah, and those are great questions. I'm trying to pull up our code right now as I'm sitting here talking, and it's not loading.
4.7165. It's the same list.
So is this existing?
Yes.
That's what I was trying to confirm. Okay. So this is our existing code. So I... And that's what I didn't know off the top of my head versus if I stole some language from somewhere else. So I would agree in general with your comment that these very specific types of uses, calling them out, even with the proposed permitted use list in the front of the zoning code, we're moving away from being very detailed like this and having more general categories. So with that said, this is our existing code. It's probably specific for a reason, in that over time in our history, we've had maybe issues with karate studios in neighborhoods, so they prohibited it at some point. So I also agree that then this should be have a conversation around this, whether this makes sense to be the right list or not, and that is all open for discussion.
I wonder if it would be helpful if, even if we're not providing our opinion, but we feel like this is something that needs to be brought up. So maybe during the public meetings or called out in questionnaires or something, like, how do people feel about this, if there's sort of flag items we might suggest to you?
Yeah.
That's helpful.
Right. So kind of a, I've thought about, you know, developing fact sheets for different topics. And so this could even, and I think the broader topic really could even be, so how we're going to treat home businesses and bed and breakfast and Airbnbs, and so kind of all clumped in together. It's like almost like quasi-commercial uses in residential settings.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we want to deal with all these kinds of things? Because there's gray areas, and I'm not sure where we draw the line between certain things and how they're all described.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think that would be a valuable way to go about it.
Yeah.
And another thing that would complicate things is, what is the volume of business for these particular items? Because somebody is a retired person, he's getting income from detailing an automobile, and he's doing one car at a time in his garage, really has no impact on the neighborhood, but potentially that's a disqualifying occupation.
Right.
Under those conditions.
Versus doing it full time with 20 cars a day.
Right, right.
Yeah, right.
You get a little bit the same thing on number 8, for instance, gun dealerships. I used to have a son that lived in Springfield, and he was had an FFL license. So, no, he didn't have a window full of guns, but technically he's a gun dealer. So somebody would, order a gun, the federal government ships it to him, puts it in a safe, and then they come and he does the background check and all of that. So, I'm just saying we have to be a little bit careful in defining what are we saying.
Yeah. I know the same thing happens a lot with auto sales, and so much of all this is online today, whether it's guns or cars or whatever, but people are buying and selling cars or whatever else. Well, the car dealer comes up because we have to sign off on DMV permits. Mm. So if we're issuing a DMV permit for a residence, we have to be clear we're not setting up for a sales lot at that property, but they can still buy and sell cars online. They're registering their permit to their home address so they can buy and sell online, but there's never cars coming and going to that residence. So it's a similar kind of thing. And so we have to figure out, with technology and businesses operate differently today, how does that all work and make sense?
And do you know from the code enforcement context, the things that people repeatedly get complaints, the city gets a lot of complaints about are commercial vehicles in residential areas. So when people are bringing appliance trucks or other large vehicles into residential areas, or and whether that's a permitted home occupation, I think that's an area that gets a lot of complaints consistently.
Did Commissioner Sherwood, did that address your comment or your concern?
Yes, I appreciate the answer, Mark, and I also appreciate the feedback and input from everybody else, so thank you.
Great.
All right. Any last comments or thoughts?
Just one offhand comment. In going through this, I kind of took note in my mind when looking at the changes proposed for ADU standards and the changes in the parking requirements. I think back to the amount of time we spent discussing that while we're going through the ADU process. I think we spent a couple of hours in two or three different sessions just talking about parking. And so now we're looking at revising everything that was done earlier. A lot of time for Sandy.
All right. Well, thank you, Mark.
Thank you. We'll see you in March. I'll be back for my regular quarterly update.
All right. Great.
Thank you.
Thanks.
All right. We have nothing else on the agenda, so I guess we're adjourned. Thanks for calling in, Troy.
Thank you, guys. Have a good one.
All right. Talk to you soon.
Not much to do this time, but thank you.
Yeah.
I got a decision.